Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Trita Parsi, and the ESPN host and author of Straight Shooter, Stephen A. Smith. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Delete Me, and Miracle Made in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, for weeks, actually months, we've talked about Trump's problems and diminishing support. It's gotten worse. He thought the Iran war would be a political winner. Quick, easy hit. He could be Patton. And affordability and Epstein would fade to the inside pages. Instead, a war that he never explained to people and is opposed by most voters is getting worse and causing him and Republicans even greater problems than they had. Huge embarrassment this week with a report that it was American bombs that killed 175 school children in Iran. You know, I think continued gas prices are devastating. But on the school killing, look, I don't think this was done intentionally. I think it was the fog of war. It was a mistake. It may have been bad targeting, but it wasn't done on purpose. But what happened is Trump lied about it. He suggested it was the Iranians who killed these young schoolgirls. And that just reinforces all those shifting line rationales. Judd Legum, I think, has counted 17. He's making it up as it goes. He's just lying. And basically, I think he now says this. I love this one today. He said Jared Kushner urged him to go to war. Kushner must have seen a lot of money making opportunities there. And his other chief clown negotiator, Steve Witkoff, said, well, Iran was on the verge of nuclear bombs. Well, I thought we obliterated those 7 months ago. Now Trump is trying to turn the focus to the Voter Suppression Act, the so-called misnamed SAVE Act, which we'll discuss later. But James, you know, I watch experts like David Petraeus and Brett McGurk speculate on how this ends. Actually, we know. When Trump fully realizes the political and economic consequences are not just a blip, they're hurting him and Republicans, we'll see another Trump taco. Trump always chickens out. This time, he never should have chickened in.
So let's start with the girls' school bombing. I'm going to give a tip of the hat to one of my senators, Senator John Kennedy. That actually, if you look up John Kennedy's educational resume, it's as good as Bill Clinton or Barack Obama's. I'm not telling you that I'm a general fan of Senator Kennedy's politics. Well, at least he had the integrity and courage to speak out against killing 135 girls in Iran. And for that, in today's Republican Party, it doesn't take much for me to give you a cadeau, but Senator Kennedy, I give you a cadeau for being absolutely and forthrightly frank on this. And every time that I think of that, I, little girls myself, and I think of that horrible thing in Texas and the flooding that you could say, well, it wasn't anybody's fault. I guess, you know, warning, but it was just gut wrenching. But I'm of the view that Iranians love their kids as much as we love our kids here. And I don't see how that is a positive event in any way, shape, or form. Steve Witkoff. I think this guy's got kids. I think he's got friends. I think people who know him.
Oh, he's got a son who's making a lot of money with Kushner.
Okay. Who are two idiots, Don Jr. and Eric have started part of a drone company to get contracts for the United States Defense Department. And I had to listen to Hunter Biden shit 6,000 times. And I can assure you, Hunter Biden shit is not 1/1,000th of what this is. But Witkoff said an interesting thing. Are you human? I asked Witkoff this. Are you an actual human being? And the reason I ask it, okay, because human beings have some qualities other than just physical care. You said you trusted Vladimir Putin, that Putin gave you his word and you trusted. Are you a human being? That you, in the year of our Lord, 2026, a man with some friends, with some family, with some reputation, would actually utter those words. Please, Ms. Witkoff, assure us that you're just actually a human being, because I don't think you are. I really don't. It's going to be the worst people that you could imagine. That's what I think I see, Witkoff.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't disagree. James, we agree the war is a disaster. He's going to get out as soon as he can when he finds out that, you know, there's nothing else he can do to turn around the political disaster at home. And the focus on the SAVE Act is wonderful. First of all, he was boxed into that by Ken Paxton in Texas, who said, yeah, I'll get out of this runoff with John Cornyn if Senate passes the SAVE Act. So Cornyn and Trump had no alternative and say, okay, that's it. The SAVE Act is a complete fraud. It says it requires a simple ID and it would prevent illegal immigrants from voting. The ID it requires is not a simple ID. 38 states require a simple ID, a driver's license, social security card, and the like. What the SAVE Act requires to vote is a passport or birth certificate, which over 20 million Americans do not have easy access to. Susan Collins, who came out for it under political pressure at home, said it's just like the ID required to fly or register in a hotel. Senator Collins, when's the last time that you had to show your birth certificate to get on an airplane or your passport to register in a hotel? This is the SAVE Act is a solution to a non-existent problem, namely migrants voting. There are scores of studies, every one of them showing it's negligible. Utah, James, not a left-wing bastion. They studied 2 million votes, and they found one by an undocumented migrant. Trump appointed his own commission in his first term, headed by Mike Pence, stacked with voting fraud zealots like Chris Kobach. After 8 months, they disbanded because they found absolutely nothing. And finally, as we've discussed, just imagine for a minute that you are an undocumented worker and you're probably scared stiff right now. You're going to go vote? It's just everything he does is phony. And this is, again, in the top of the list.
So yesterday, I was listening to Dan Abrams, a podcast or show or whatever he has. And he had on, and as far as the guy's name, last name starts with S, was Mark Fest at Hofstra. And it was excellent. Everybody should watch it because they walk through this entire thing in very explainable terms as to how many people it would actually disenfranchise. I really want to recommend this. It's a subject that I know you have been of particular interest in. I am now officially really of particular interest in this. And I say this for Ken Paxton. That was a shrewd political maneuver. And I mean, the tension between Thune and Trump is just unbelievable. And of course, Cornyn by extension, who is Thune's guy, he spent $77 million. And then the first poll came out, by the way, on that runoff, and Paxton's up by 9 points. And he just checkmated Cornyn by saying, hey, you get it passed, I'll drop out. It was a brilliant political move by Ken Paxton. I could say whatever you want about him as a human being, I'd be totally fine. But as a political move, man, this might be the best move of the whole cycle. He said, look, if you get that pass, I'll drop out. Yep, it's just brilliant.
Yep.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it sure was. And James, I would add to those who want to find out more about the SAVE Act, in addition to what you recommended, go to the Brennan Center. The Brennan always. Center just is the, you know, I mean, it is always the best. And this one, they have done just such terrific in-depth work. I mean, again, I come back, I couldn't believe Susan Collins saying, hey, it's just like getting on an airplane. You know, James, have you ever showed your birth certificate to get on an airplane?
Yeah, I'll ask this question about Susan Collins. Is she the female version of Lindsey Graham?
She may have probably no one's that bad.
Well, the idea that I would let me do some research because I think she probably isn't. Okay, I agree. It's, nobody can be worse than Lindsey Graham, but this is about as bad as you can be when in some desperate attempt to cling to power, you're willing to disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans. I don't know. I don't know since Collins, but I probably no one could match for duplicity, for cowardness, for anything you can imagine. I know that Lindsey Graham is the gold standard, but I'm beginning to wonder if Susan Collins might not be at a minimum the silver standard. We should consider that. Maybe we'll do one segment on who's more odiously and compliant, Susan Collins or Lindsey. And I'm sure that Senator Collins will tell us that she's, quote, concerned, unquote.
We can put them both. We can put them both on the stand. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. You know, that is a state that over the course of the years produced disproportionately more good senators than probably any state in the country based on their population size. Margaret Chase Smith, Ed Muskie, George Mitchell, Bill Cohen, Angus Kim. I mean, it really is. It's Olympia Snow. Right. It really is amazing. And, you know, I'll just leave it at that. I don't even have to go back to Joshua Chamberlain. I'm not sure he was in the Senate, James.
I don't think he was.
Bowdoin University.
I don't think he was. But whenever you talk about Maine, you got to talk about Joshua Chamberlain. But at any rate, when you think of, so if you said, is she Lindsey or not? Well, in terms of United States senators, you ain't had much from South Carolina, to be honest with you. You want John C. Calhoun? I don't want to go there. Strom Thurmond, well, probably not.
He got a little bit better in his later years, but you're right.
Yeah, I mean a little bit. But I mean, you look at the giants that have come from Maine, and then you compare Susan Collins to them, and then you look at the midgets that have come from South Carolina, and then you compare Lindsey Graham to him, well, the differential is a lot higher in Maine, I guess I'd say. A lot higher in Maine.
I would make only one small caveat, and that's Fritz Hollings. Fritz Hollings was a terrific senator and a terrific governor and a terrific person. But your point is undeniable.
Right, it's undeniable. Yeah. It's that. Might be the greatest differential in one senator in senatorial history, who is the worst compared to all the rest? I think Collins and Horn. Lindsey may be worse than her, but compared to them, she wins the award. But it's hard. Maine's a tough state. You know, maybe Pennsylvania, but they ain't had much either, to be honest with you.
You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and it is the biggest. They have never had what I would consider a really major political figure, namely, you know, someone who was one of the three or four people you turned to in a party or ran for president or won the presidency. You know, the last one, the one that won the presidency of Pennsylvania was James Buchanan, who was, you know, who may have been the worst president ever until Trump came along.
He would be in the discussion. Well, you know, I think Josh Shapiro is a person of real, real promise. And, you know, he could, if I look at Josh, I would say he might
could be. I mean, and Yeah, and I'm talking about a different thing. I mean, Bob Casey, I think, was a good senator, and there have been other good senators, but they weren't really national figures.
That had some. I think you said John Hines was actually a good senator. All right?
He was.
I mean, I'm not.
He was.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah. We're no good senators. But if you take Fetterman and McCormick, that might be as bad a combo as we got in the Senate right now. It really might be. I don't know if you throw it out.
Wait a minute. Let me think that one through. Who do we have in Mississippi? Well, actually, Roger Wicker's not bad.
Cindy Hyde Smith is historically awful. Roger Wicker is not. It's not bad. He's not that bad at all. It's the same thing in Alabama. You got Tuberville, but you got Katie Britt, who's shown at least some.
She says she does.
Yeah, she might have been a little better. I mean, when we're talking about the bottom of the bottom. All right,
James. I don't even know who the other senator is in Arkansas besides Tom Cotton. I used to know every House member. And I can't. Who's the other senator besides Tom Cotton?
Something like that. I think his name is Boozman. Broken up yet? What do you got? Mark Wayne Mullen. Wait a minute. Oklahoma. Mark Wayne Mullen.
No, he's good. The other guy's good. Jim, you know what's his name? Is a good conservative. He's been.
I like it. Yeah. I'm sorry. I apologize to the great state of Oklahoma. No, that you're right.
My wife will appreciate it.
But Mullen, Cindy Hyde Smith, Tommy Tuberville. Man, that would be a hell of a contest.
Yeah. I don't know who the new senator is from Florida. Well, I know who it is. I don't know anything about her.
Her name she is seems kind of like. I don't even know who she is. She was appointed by DeSantis.
Right.
According to news reports, Rick Scott.
And you got that. Well, I mean, that's a competitor. And the last one I would mention, how about Montana? I mean, you got this guy Daines who just pulled a quick one, and then you got this Sheehy. New one, Sheehy, who really, is a piece of work. So we'll get into some of this stuff later. Do you, we'll wrap this up, but do you, I'm almost sure you do, you agree that Trump was in bad shape 2 or 3 weeks ago? He's in worse shape today.
I do. And by the way, you see that border trail green at Georgia 14th? What analysts need to do is focus in on Whitfield County. I think that's kind of center of corporate making. And there was, a 50-point turnaround. And it's one of the more Hispanic counties in Georgia. And there was like a 50-point turnaround in the Hispanic vote. I'm going to tell you right now, I officially now am ready to declare this. Redistricting in Texas is going to blow up in their face. That there has been a consistent, undeniable, and huge shift in the Hispanic vote around the country. And I think it's going to continue. But the significant thing that happened in Georgia last night was Whitfield County.
Yeah. Well, James, Texas and California, they each supposedly created 5 more favorable districts, R in Texas, D in California. It's going to be a wash. I guarantee you take those 2 states, the Democrats will pick up a net of at least 2 or 3.
Yeah, I got to single out a particular asshole in California, and I think it's California's 3. The guy's name is Kilroy or something like that. He's the Republican congressman that decided that he was going to leave the Republican Party. And this was the logic, as best I can determine it, because of Gavin Newsom and his redistricting, and he was going to run as an independent, but he was going to caucus with the Republicans. So let me something, you asshole. Was Gavin Newsom just riding between Sacramento and San Francisco one day and says, I think I'll just redistrict California. It just come to my mind, and I'm just going to do this. Because that's what Mr. Kill, whatever the fuck his name is, wants you to believe. Sir, is there another, is there a sequence of events that precipitated Governor Newsom to do this? And why are you too chicken shit to tell the truth? No one had ever thought of this, was never going to do it until your boy, who you got your nose so far up his fucking ass is coming out of his mouth, Donald Trump, said we're going to do it in Texas. And then you come out and blame Gavin Newsom. You little fucking dweeb. You want to know what I really think?
Well, he may be bad, but I'll tell you, the guy who's leaving, who I think is worse, is Daryl Issa. Daryl Issa has really been, he really is a deplorable. He has come and he's done nothing but, I mean, when he was supposed to be a chief investigator in the House, he just made an utter fool of himself. And he came, he got lots of money, lots of bullshit, and it's good riddance, Daryl Issa.
Yeah, but the difference, I'd have said, we all knew Daryl Issa was a piece of shit. We didn't know about this guy. I mean, he exploded on the scene. That quick ascent. Maybe he hadn't reached him, but man, have you made a fool of yourself.
Okay, we discussed lots, got lots more to discuss ahead and next week. Hey, James, our guest is Trita Parsi, Iranian-born, Swedish-raised, foreign policy expert, especially on Iranian-U.S. relations. Critics accuse him of being pro the Iranian regime. He says he's trying to work on better U.S.-Iran relations. Trita, you have communicated with people in Tehran and elsewhere over the last 10 days. The U.S. and Israeli bombing has inflicted massive damage and deaths. Wiped out a lot of weapons and infrastructure. Trump and Netanyahu thought that would eventually, actually fairly soon, lead to an uprising against a repressive regime. What's the sense that you get now in talking to people in Iran?
Thanks so much, Alan James, for having me on. Let me just say one thing, if I could. Yes, there are elements who have wanted to have this war between the United States and Iran for more than 20 years who have been very upset by my efforts and others' efforts to try to prevent it. And as a result, have made all kinds of preposterous and unjustified accusations of supporting the regime or anything of that kind in order to try to cancel or silence us. It hasn't worked, but unfortunately, they have managed to get their war. And we see now how problematic that war is. Talking to people on the ground in Iran, I think it's a very clear sense they are taking massive, massive hits. The Israelis in particular have been striking Iranian civilian targets quite extensively. We saw the refinery that was bombed a couple of days ago that made it next to impossible for people to breathe in Tehran. They last night started to hit banks. And now the authorities have urged people to avoid being anywhere near 1 kilometer of any of the banks in Iran. Now, of course, banks in Iran are spread out in the city the same way that it is in the United States. The Iranians believe that this set of targets suggests that what the Israelis at this point are looking for is state collapse by going after institutions and elements for the state to even be able to uphold itself. I think the more obvious observation, however, is that Trump had a very unrealistic expectation. He thought that this was going to be very easy. He thought that he's going to have another Venezuela and that within 4 days, the Iranians would either surrender or collapse.
It would be spontaneous. It would be spontaneous.
It would be spontaneous. And it's not working out that way at all. Not because this regime in any way, shape, or form is popular, but because it is much stronger than what Trump was led to believe and what he chose to believe at the end of the day. And as a result, we're now in a scenario in which the United States actually, frankly, does not seem to have a plan. It doesn't have a strategy, doesn't have a decision on what the goals are. And it is at this point improvising the war that is at this point, increasingly being defined by the Iranians in terms of what the geography of the war is and what the length of this war is. And their strategy is to wreck as much as possible of the global economy in order to pressure Trump into backing off.
And let me ask you this. Do you, right now, how deeply embedded, entrenched are the Revolutionary Guards and the regime as it is in Iran. I mean, we know they were protesters, but you know what I'm trying to figure out is how different this is from Venezuela and even Iraq in 2003.
No, it's frankly night and day between Venezuela and Iran, as well as Iraq, for that matter. Again, it's very important to understand that it's not because this theocracy in any way, shape, or form is popular, but it does have roughly 15 to perhaps 20% support within the country. And those supporters tend to be very, very adamant and committed in their support. And that's roughly 18 million people, given the size of that country. So their entrenchment is such that it makes it very different from the regime of this, Saddam Hussein, for instance, in which if you did take out the top person in that regime, everything else would fall down. This is what the administration thought would happen. They thought that the assassination of the supreme leader would either lead to the implosion of the regime or their surrender. And instead, we've seen quite the opposite. We've seen that their support base has been energized. They're closing ranks. The population, as much as they dislike the government, is starting to show the same type of rallying around the flag phenomenon that we see in almost every other country that is bombed from the air. And that is at least in the short run benefiting them. I don't think it will benefit them in the long run, because we saw that also in summer. During the summer, when the Israelis were bombing Iran, there was waves of nationalism that spread throughout the country. A couple of months after the war, it was gone. And it was back to business as usual. And people were very, very upset with this theocracy. And we saw the massive protests that then followed in January.
Tell me this. Do you, when you talk to people there, and you have to guess what the leaders think because they haven't been very accessible. The question is time on the side of the U.S. and the Israelis, or is time on the side of the Iranians?
If you were just to compare the military capabilities of Iran and Israel and the United States, then, I mean, this is a no-brainer. Obviously, the United States and Israel, particularly combined, are far superior to the Iranians. But the Iranians have something else that they think works in their favor. They have a much higher pain tolerance, and they believe that Trump's political pain tolerance is much, much lower. This is part of the reason why they're attacking the GCC states. They're trying to collapse the oil markets. They're trying to shoot up global inflation in order for that to lead to inflation in the U.S. that will then lead to his supporters, his MAGA base, to come out against this war. So the question is, whose pain threshold will be reached first? I think the Israelis are off the charts on this. The support in Israel for this war is massive, and the Israelis have a very high pain tolerance, particularly after October 7th. The U.S.'s pain tolerance when it comes to troops getting killed may be higher than what the Iranians think that it is. Besides, the Iranians still have a difficulty reaching those troops because most of them have been removed from the region or are on these ships that are far outside of Iran's reach. But the pain tolerance of the global economy, which then translates into the political pain tolerance of Trump, that seems to be where the Iranians are putting their focus. And whether that threshold will be reached first or whether the Iranians will lose militarily, no one knows. But so far, it doesn't seem like it's going in Trump's way, because if this was actually successful for Trump, this would have been over with a week ago.
James.
Everyone, just not focus on the regime, but I want to focus on Iran and Iranian people. Okay, I hear two views from Americans who say, they're just a bunch of goddamn nomads out there running around the fucking desert, you know, wipe their ass with their hands. and just sitting there causing trouble in the world and all shit. Other people that tell me, man, that's a really sophisticated country. They have sophisticated art. They actually publish more books than every other Arab-speaking country in the world combined. That half the people in Iran have a college education. Of those, half are females. This is the original, I hate to say it any other way, sounds racist. The Caucasus Mountains is where the Caucasian race came from. It's where the fuck my ancestors came from. And these are sophisticated people with a sophisticated culture, with sophisticated art, sophisticated literature, sophisticated scientific knowledge. And my own personal view, in the entire history of U.S.-Iranian relationships, the United States has made 100% wrong decisions. We've never done a fucking thing right to show any respect for this country. And then we wonder why they hate us. Am I right or am I wrong?
I won't comment on the first couple of things you said, but on the latter point, I do think that by and large, you are right. Look, that doesn't mean that the Iranians haven't also done a tremendous amount of things that were huge mistakes on their end that they absolutely should not have done. But yes, no, look, this is one of the most ancient civilizations in the world. It is not an Arab country. It's one of the few countries right next to the Arab Peninsula that was Islamized but never Arabized. As a result, their identity is not Arab. Their language is not Arab. They retained a lineage that goes back 3,000-4,000 years. In fact, you can read Persian from the 6th century, and it's pretty much the same language as it was then. So it's one of the languages that actually has been retained in its same shape for a very long period of time. It has a bureaucracy that is one of the oldest in the world, very, very sophisticated. In fact, the entire Roman Empire was based on how Darius the Great organized the Persian Empire that preceded the Roman Empire with several centuries. So they have this history. They also have this view of themselves as an empire, as a great power, which is part of the reason why they're particularly sensitive to any effort by a foreign power, even if it's a vastly more powerful power, to try to seek its submission and surrender. That's why I think surrender was never in the cards. Trump was completely misled in thinking that this was something that he could achieve. And I spoke to the administration throughout this period, and I made it very clear. You're not going to scare the Iranians by moving more aircraft carriers there, because you're assuming that they fear war more than they fear surrender. They fear surrender far more than they fear war. They think they can survive this war. They think that even if they lose the war, they will survive, whereas they cannot survive a surrender. That would be completely obliterating their base of support inside the country, which again, I think is no more than 20%, but enough to keep them in power for now. We've committed huge mistakes. And one of the biggest mistakes just in the last couple of weeks is this. The Omanis, who were asked by the United States to mediate in this diplomacy that took place, revealed on CBS News that the deal that they had managed to get the Iranians to agree to was far superior than what the Obama administration managed to get in 2015. And I was an informal advisor to the Obama administration at the time, and I'm strongly supportive of the JCPOA. But in many aspects, this was way beyond that. In the JCPOA, the Iranians would be able to keep 300 kilos of low-enriched uranium on their soil at any point. Under this deal, zero stockpile of enrichment. They would never be able to have any stockpile. Without a stockpile, you cannot build a bomb. Trump had the option of declaring victory. But because he was led to believe that the Iranians are so weak that only surrender is acceptable, he chose instead to declare war.
So let me make a point about a significant question I want to ask you. It seems like we took out an 86-year-old asshole and put a 56-year-old SO in his place. I mean, he wasn't going to be there. I mean, just be honest, he probably had a pretty limited time frame. But I saw the picture of the square in Tehran. And I got to tell you, there were a lot of people there. And as I understand, Tehran is not the strong spot of the regime. It's more like it's out in rural, where the clerics
Absolutely. And
more fundamental people. So, Los Angeles has a very, very large Iranian expat community, very prosperous, educated people. I mean, highly, highly. What is the Iranian expat in the United States, of which there are a lot, of which are major contributors to the prosperity and culture and knowledge of the United States? If I detest the regime, if I don't like the clerics, I think they were a disaster. My grandfather was for the Shah. That's how big I am. What are they feeling right now? Are they feeling encouraged by what they're seeing? Or are they just like, oh shit, we're just going about this the wrong way?
So the Iranian American community is currently quite split on this issue. Just a year and a half ago, support for war was polling at no more than 5%. Support for the JCPOA polled at 80%. So you have a community that actually used to be very much in favor of diplomacy, very skeptical of the sanctions, and definitely against the war. Over time, this has changed for a variety of reasons. I think the fact that the theocracy killed several thousand people in the January protest definitely pushed up the support for wars quite significantly because people are rightfully just furious with it. LA has long time been a central command of support for the Shah, for the monarchy, and for the son of the former Shah. And that's been the case because that was like old money that came in from Iran immediately after the after the revolution. But polls have shown now that even under these circumstances, a majority was not in support of this war. You may have seen a lot of images of people, you know, cheering and dancing, etc. That was not reflective of the entire community. It was reflective of a portion of the community. The community is split right now, but the trend in the last 7 days, I would say, has become more and more clear. The support for the war is becoming less and less because people are also seeing it wasn't that fast victory that Trump had in mind. That many of these exiles actually also may have played a role in convincing him, saying that the Islamic Republic is a paper tiger. And now they're seeing that the entire country is being blown up. They're seeing that Trump is saying that Iran's map may no longer look the way it does after this war, which is a threat against its territorial integrity. That's not a war against the regime, that's a war against the country. The more that is seen, the more they're seeing that, you know, blowing up desalination plants and refineries, etc., and people getting killed, and not seeing people rising up. Instead, they're seeing exactly what you pointed out, James, which is the support base of this theocracy has actually been energized by this war. Those were huge crowds. Huge crowds. And if you were to believe that everyone who's been telling Trump to go in this direction, that would never happen. Instead, people would have been rising up and overthrowing the regime as soon as the bomb started to fall. And we did not see that. I am part of the Iranian American community, but I've always been very sensitive about the fact that the United States should be very careful not to fall for the fantasies that exiles bring in the hope of being able to use the US's military power to achieve their own objectives. From my standpoint, this was never in the U.S. interest to do. Getting involved in another major war in the Middle East, in my view, is an absolute disaster. That doesn't mean that I in any way, shape, or form support this regime or would not like to see this regime fall. I would love to see this regime fall. But this regime has to fall at the hands of the Iranian people from the inside in order for there to actually be a transition to democracy and not just be a transition to another variation of a regime that also will be repressive and probably not long-lasting.
Before I go, I'm going to turn it over now, but I want to say something to you personally, and I want you to convey this to all your friends here that are Iranian and all the people you know in Iran, that James Carville holds your culture and your country in the very highest esteem. And one of his fondest hopes is that he's 81 years old, that before he died, he would get to go to Iran to experience and see the great art, the great architecture, the great achievements, and interact with Iranian people and learn a lot. Unfortunately, I don't, given the time schedule that we own, I may not do it. But please, sir, express my admiration to Iranian culture, Iranian history, and Iranian people that I am a huge admirer. And I fervently hope that one day you'll have a country that will realize and offer its citizens the full potential of the amazing, amazing talent they have. It's a big honor to have you on the show.
Thank you, James.
I know this is a dark time for your country, and I want you to know that my heart is with you in every possible way it can be. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, James. I think a lot of your audience would be very heartened by that message. And I just want to say one thing as well. One of the things that I always hoped for was to see the friendship that should exist and can exist and have existed between Iranians and Americans to be able to flourish again. A lot of people may know what happened in 1953 when the United States overthrew the democratically elected prime minister in Iran. Well, actually, most people probably don't know, but even less people know that there was an American that played a crucial role in the 1906 constitutional revolution in Iran, Baskerville. In which the Iranians were trying to establish their own constitution, which they eventually did. He died for that cause. And Americans were seen in Iran for decades as a major force against colonization, against the colonial powers. That all unfortunately changed in 1953. But there is a fascinating and extremely positive relationship between Americans and Iranians prior to that. And hopefully we can get back to that one day. Unfortunately, this war is going to make it much worse, much more difficult.
Wish I could help open a Cajun or Persian restaurant.
James has so elevated this conversation that I feel guilty going back to what's happening there, but I'm still going to do it. Suppose Trump sends in ground troops, which, by the way, I think he won't. I think he's just BSing, as he always does, special forces into Iran. What would be the consequences, do you think?
I think it would be a disaster. I think this war already is a disaster at this point. I think it's quite clear that Trump is improvising, that he doesn't have a plan. And sending in ground troops, I mean, without a doubt, U.S. firepower and ground troops are, you know, the Iranians are going to have a huge difficulty. But it will also give this theocracy the opportunity to kill a lot of Americans and hope to raise the cost for the U.S. to conduct this.
They could do other things. There are asymmetrical attacks, like what?
Well, I mean, right now they're doing it by striking at the GCC states, striking at ships in the region, in the Persian Gulf, closing the Strait of Hormuz. We've not seen any clear evidence that they're engaging in any terrorist activities, outside. There was always a fear of that. I always felt that was a bit exaggerated, not because they haven't done it in the past, but because for the last 20 years, they've kind of dismantled much of that machinery. Just take a look at the map. This is a country three times the size of Iraq. Look at the topography. This is a topography that is extremely unkind to any invaders. Whereas Iraq is mostly flat until you get to the north of the country. Iran is surrounded by these mountains. It's going to be extremely costly and difficult. Not terribly different from parts of Afghanistan, of course. So I do think, of course, the U.S. has an overwhelming firepower, but this will be extremely costly. And the question is, for what end? How does this serve U.S. interest? And I don't see any valid argument from the administration or anyone else that actually can say that this is in the interest of the United States to do this.
Well, I think for his own political interest, he's not going to do it, but we'll see. Let me just ask you this. Two minority groups in Iran are the Kurds, the North, and the Arabs in the South. How are they reacting? How are they being treated in Iran?
So Iran is a country of plenty of minorities. Roughly 50% of the population is Persian, and the rest of the population are various ethnic groups. Most of them are obviously very close, but their language differs, etc. The Kurds is a major group. Arabs in the South, where my family is from, are also a major group. The Kurds have a long history of groups that have been fighting for either independence or far greater rights within the Iranian system. The Kurds and many of these minorities have been oppressed. It's not the same level of oppression, for instance, that the Kurds have faced in Iraq or in Syria, but nevertheless. And there's also an interest among certain other states. The Israelis have invested heavily in the Kurds of Iraq as well as the Kurds in Iran to use that as a lever against Iranians, just as much as the Iranians have been doing that with Shias in Lebanon, for instance. We're not seeing any clear signs at this point, however, that there is that type of a turmoil on the ground. I think the Iranians are very sensitive to it, and they've really clamped down very hard. There are Kurdish groups that are in Washington right now lobbying to see if the United States at a minimum can give them air cover so that they can start doing attacks. It doesn't seem like Trump has made a final decision on that, but his earlier talk of arming the Kurds seems to have been shut down primarily, I suspect, by Turkey, who is obviously very, very sensitive about any such scenario.
And how about the Arabs from your home area?
There is far less of a history there in terms of that type of movement. There are groups, without a doubt, but it is not in any way, shape, or form the same type of organization or on the ground type of a support for that. The Iranians are even more sensitive about that because the areas in which you have Arab minorities in large size are exactly the areas where Iran's oil is, which is in the Khuzestan region. Yeah. This is also what Saddam Hussein tried to do in his war in 1980. He called that region Arabistan rather than Khuzestan and wanted to so-called liberate them. But that would mean that Iran would lose most of its oil fields. And Iran has obviously fought to death in order to protect that.
It's been reported that MBS, the Saudi leader, was completely encouraging behind this strike on Iran. I don't have any proof of this, but if you ask me, do I suspect that money was changed hands? I suspect money was changed hands, okay? Is this going to stiffen the resistance of the Iranian people against it? Because I don't think the Saudi or MBS is a particularly popular guy in Iran. Is that a fair observation?
No, but the Iranians have had a rapprochement with Saudi Arabia that both sides have viewed as very, very positive and important. I think from the Iranian side, they would like it to go much further. I think the thing that the Saudis, what I've been able to piece together, I'm not claiming that this is, you know, finally proven, but what I've been able to piece together, James, by talking to a lot of people, including those who spoke directly to Trump about this, is that the Saudis actually lobbied against the war at the foreign ministry level. But MBS himself, who runs his own foreign policy, actually towards the end, at least, was pushing in favor of it and quite strongly. So I think there was a split there. I think the Iranians know this. They're not happy about it. Whether that has made a huge difference in terms of how they've been striking Saudi territory, U.S. bases there, I'm not so sure. But the Iranians are going to be careful not to turn any tensions with Saudi Arabia into a deeper enmity, because they paid a heavy price, as did Saudi Arabia when that was the case. They're very happy that they managed to pull it out of that territory. But at this point, I got to tell you, this theocracy treats this as an existential battle. That's part of the reason why they don't seem to be thinking too much about what happens in their relations with their neighbors once this war is over, if they survive.
Thank you very much. Trita Parsi, you've been a fabulous guest. We've learned a lot, and I just hope that you'll come back. So thank you so much. It's really been a terrific treat.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
But folks, we have, which is undoubtedly the greatest sports broadcast in history. Please don't argue with me. Look at how long he's been on. And, you know, it does matter. Look at the size of his contract. But, Stephen, I want to ask you a political question. I'm very serious.
Yes, sir.
I'm a Democrat. We do not know how to communicate with young men.
Yeah.
You might be the best person in the world communicating with young men.
Mm-hmm.
Give advice to Democratic strategists, how myself, how do we reconnect with young men? What should we be doing, political talk? We can't be you,
yeah,
but we can be a lot better.
Well, first order of business, it's great to see you guys, honored to be here. Let me say this. Wisdom obviously is incredibly important, because the older you are, the wiser you are, the more experienced you are, the more youngsters recognize that they have to be somewhat deferential. But whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, particularly in today's generation, it's important that they recognize that you respect them, and you don't talk at them, you talk to them. And you talk to them in a language that they're willing to embrace and inhale. When you come to them like, you're older, they're younger, they don't know a damn thing, shut the hell up and listen, the last thing they're going to do is listen. When you talk to them like they're the problem, they're going to be quick to point out that whatever problems exist, you preceded them. So you are part of the problem even more so than they are, because they inherited it. So they're looking to blame you for it. So it's just a level of authenticity and accountability that you have to speak to members of the younger generation in that regard. But in the same breath, letting them know you're only telling it to them because you care and you want them to be okay. You're trying to look out for them. Whereas even if they don't agree with you, they're not questioning your intent. With politics, you always find yourself asking, what's the objective? What's the agenda of the people talking to you? Because we all grow up feeling like politicians lie to us at every turn, and that these pundits are bought and paid for by whatever side of the aisle they tilt towards. And those kind of things dissipates the level of trust that somebody's going to have in you. And when somebody doesn't trust you, especially when they're young, the last thing they're going to do is listen to you. They don't want to hear a damn word you got to say if they don't trust that you're coming with it from a good place.
So, I'm going to just admit, I saw you earlier in sports broadcasting, and I said to myself, this is an interesting guy, but he's going to burn himself out. I was dead wrong. I completely admit that. And what you did, I think, is interesting. You came in hot, you stayed hot, you're still hot. Your first broadcast is not 5% different than your last broadcast. Am mm-hmm. I correct in that assessment?
For the most part, there are days where I ebb and flows. You know, you get headaches, you're frustrated with something that happened off the air, you bring that stuff on the air and stuff like that. You know, nobody's perfect all the time, but I pride myself when I'm talking to an audience that, you know what, I'm going to bring the goods. I'm going to deliver. That's my mentality. You know, you're tuning in to listen to me, to view me. You know, you have an expectation, and my goal is to live up to that expectation in terms of my energy, my fervor, my passion, how much I care, et cetera, et cetera. I think I owe that to a listening audience because, you know what, they didn't just listen to you. You asked them to. You went on the public airwaves, and when you do so, you're asking people to gravitate towards you. So because that's the reality, you owe it to them to give them all you've got in any particular moment and to let them know, you know what, well, no matter what energy you think you have, when it comes to listening to me, I got just as much, if not more, in me talking to you. And that's how I come at it with, that's how I come to work with it.
So, I have a theory that's kind of guided me, and I'm going to ask you if you can, but I think it guides you. You know, when I said that I wrote in the New York Times, I thought Kamala Harris was going to win the election, and I was wrong. But I have a theory. People will not blame you for being wrong, but they will blame you for being boring.
They'll blame you for being boring, but they'll blame you even more for being fake. You know, right. I mean, everybody doesn't have the same level of energy, but there's never an excuse for not being real. There's never an excuse. I mean, when you're fake, when you're somebody that comes across as inauthentic, I don't care how old you are, nobody's forgiving that because that's a choice. That's not something you can, that it's not viewed as something that you can't help. It's viewed as something that you could help. You elected to engage in deception. You elected to try to fool somebody. And when people notice that, they're going to be very unforgiving about it. And people like me and you, James, we don't blame them because, you know, I don't think anybody would ever accuse you of being inauthentic. The James Carville that we see now, we've always seen. The same Stephen A. that you see, you always seen. And we're quick to tell somebody to kiss our ass. You know what? You're full of shit. Because if that's how we feel about them, that's exactly how we're going to come across. We're going to let them know.
So one of the things that I don't like to ask experts in sports, and people ask me all the time, I don't get mad about it, but who's going to win? The truth of the matter is, I'm not sure. You know, you get staff working for you, your mm-hmm. contacts, anybody's going to return sure. your phone calls, obviously. You have a wealth of information. I see every poll. People text me polls. I talk to people. The truth of the matter is, I'm not a very good predictor of elections.
Okay.
And you know, if I say to you, this is Stephen A., who do you think is going to, you know, be win the Final Four? You'll have an opinion, but the truth, if I ask Bill Belichick, who's he think is going to win the Super Bowl? He knows more football than any of us know, but I don't know right. if he can predict the outcome of a game any better. Do you?
True. But there's a flip side to that. And the flip side okay. to it is that people listen to who they want to listen to because they don't have a choice to listen to everybody. And so it's not an expectation that you're going to be right all the time, that you're never going to be wrong. It's an expectation that your opinion comes from an informed place. This is what you believe and here's why. And a lot of times, whether it's to agree or disagree with you, people are confiding in you about what their thoughts are and are seeking what to hear from your thoughts because they want to be smarter. They want to be validated as to what they believe or they want to be edified as to what they're missing. And now they're no longer missing it because of you. And so a lot of times I'll sit up there. I have my data. I have my analytics. I have my research, et cetera. Right. And I'll come up with an opinion knowing that it's possible that I could be wrong. But more often than not, I'm not going to be because I have this information along with what I have visualized and what I have seen and what my sources, my you know, that I've networked with and the information that I've been able to gather and what I witnessed. This is what I deduce from all of that. And because of that, and it's coming from an informed place, people are like, okay, I can vibe with that. That doesn't mean that I can't be wrong. It's just that you being in politics all of this year, that's far deeper. And this is what I tell people all the time. In the end, when you're talking about sports, you're talking about games. You talk about athletes, you talk about money and all that stuff, and that's real. But in the end, you're talking about a game. When you talk about politics, you talk about real life. You talk about the economy. You're talking about immigration. You're talking about healthcare. You're talking about entitlements. You're talking about safety in the streets of America. You're talking about all of these things that directly have an impact on American citizens through no choice of their own. Sports is a choice. People that get involved in it, they want to. But politics touch you whether you like it or not, because it directly affects your life, taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And so because right. that's the reality, people are going to be far more harsh with somebody like yourself who's entrenched in politics than somebody like me who was entrenched in sports all of these years before I got involved in politics over the last year.
So a lot of times people will say to me, who do you think should win? I say, well, let me tell you, if the Democrat stays focused on real issues and connects with real people
yes.
and doesn't drift into some of this silliness, then yeah. if they execute well, I think they can win. So, you know, if somebody asks you about who's going to win a ball game, a basketball game, because
yes.
it's current right now. Mm-hmm. Well, if they manage the ball well, and that, you know, they retain possession 93% of the time, and that they hit free, you know, that they shoot 38% from the three line, and they shoot, okay. you know, X from the foul line, they'll win the game. But if they don't do that, they're not going to win the game.
Right.
We've talked to this, and you were one of the few people I've ever known that got a very positive treatment from John Oliver, who I think is one of the most courageous people in television, by the way.
Okay.
I think that guy. And so if you had a career in soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I think people find it interesting. tell me a little bit about your career in soap operas.
Man, I've had a recurring role on General Hospital, the soap opera on ABC television, for the last 7 or 8 years or so. My character's name is Brick. I'm a surveillance expert for the mob. And what happened is that I've been watching General Hospital since I was 8 years old. I'm the youngest of six. I have four older sisters. I grew up in Hollis, Queens, New York. We had one TV in the house at the time. And if you wanted to watch TV, it had to be the soaps. And if you didn't want to watch soaps, you had to go and do homework. Well, what kid do you know is going to choose homework over watching television if they have the choice between the two? They're going to watch television. And so as a result, that's what I did. And I've been watching soaps literally since I was 8 years old. I'm 58 now. So I've been watching it for 50 years. And in 2016, 2017, even though I had made a cameo, a 10-second cameo in 2007, in 2016, 2017, they invited me back to that because they had heard, watched me on television, that I was a huge General Hospital fan. And they asked me to come there and to do a scene with the star of the show, who is played by Maurice Bernard. His character's name is Sonny Corinthos. And I did a scene with him. And the next thing I know, his eyes are wide open. And he was like, you were fantastic. And the executive producer, Frank Valentini, comes running down the stairs. And he says, you were great. Do you have time to do this? I said, I don't understand what you mean. He said, we want to make your character a recurring role on this show. He said, do you have the time? I said, man, I'll make time. Don't you worry about it. I'll find the time. And it was that simple. I didn't audition. I didn't do anything. I made one appearance. They loved my appearance. And they've kept me on the show ever since. A matter of fact, I was a little bit late getting to the seat for this interview because Frank Valentini just texted me and said, I need you here on March 26th. To tape a few scenes for General Hospital. And I said, all right, I'll be there. So that was what held me up.
I want to say, I have a history of soap operas in my career in politics. In 1994, I went to work in Brazil for a man named Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who actually won the election. And he turned out to be, I think, one of the best presidents in the history of Brazil. But so I went down, I met with him, and he said, James, you know, I speak English, okay? He said, right. You need to meet with the president of Globo, which is the national television network in Brazil.
Right? Okay.
And he said, they love soap operas. The Brazilians watch soap operas. At lunch, they watch right. soap operas. So I met with the guy Globo. And, it, you know, when people say it's a conspiracy, it actually was a conspiracy. Globo was trying to help us. And he said, you got any idea? I said, well, why don't you get whatever the Portuguese name for, I don't know, Nurse Ratched and Dr. Right. John. And of course, you had this terrible inflation then. They called it the real, was the name of the currency. And so you lead up, you got this steamy scene, and they're getting ready to go get it on in the janitor's closet.
Yeah.
And Nurse Ratched said, I can't. I got to go to the bank and change my reals. And all the crowd was, oh, shit, man, because they thought they were going to get something. Inflation was stopping them.
I love it.
I mean, you can tell a story in a soap opera.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And it's like you're just having a lot of fun with it. And listen, I never thought I would get more involved in acting, but I'm going to. And the reason why is because you just find yourself creating these scenes and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you're just like, wait a minute. I can get away with whatever the character allows me to get away with. Like for me, just a few months ago, I murdered somebody. I shot him in the hospital. I was like, well, I can't. I'm not trying to do that in real life. I like my life. I ain't trying to go to prison. But on the soaps, I could pull that off, you know? I mean, a few months from now, I might have to torture somebody to get some information out of them for my boss. Well, guess what? I'm looking forward to that. Another time, I told him to make a hold off on this because, you know, I become so popular, you know, James, they want me to do a love scene. You know, and I'm like this. I'm like, you know, I'm slim. I'm getting in shape. I'm not out of shape the way that I used to be, but I'm not satisfied. I'm taking off my shirt on national television. I got to have my sexy ready. I got to have it ready. So I'm getting in the gym and I told them to hold off for a couple of months. So when I take off my shirt, I'm representing appropriately. So, you know, I have aspirations, no doubt about it, and I'm looking forward to it. But soap operas are wonderful. And here's the thing. The biggest soap opera star, arguably, in American history is a role played by Eric Braeden, whose name in the soap operas is Victor Newman of Young and the Restless. Now, I don't appear on that soap because I work for Disney, which owns ABC, and General Hospital's on ABC, and I grew up watching General Hospital. But he's a dear friend because he's a huge sports fan whose son is a big-time director. Christian did Den of Thieves 1 and 2 along with various other shows and stuff like that. And he said to his dad, Eric Braeden, you got to meet this dude. This is the best sports analyst in the world. You got to meet him. And Eric Braeden watched me and texted me, you know, or tweeted at me, rather, to meet me. And somebody came up to me on my team. They was like, Eric Braden's texting you. Eric Braden's texting. And I said, who the hell is Eric Braeden? I had no idea. And they were like, Victor Newman on Young and the Restless. Next thing you know, I said, oh. And I go out there like 2 weeks later. I meet him for lunch. This is nearly 15 years ago. And right? We meet. Every time I'm in L.A., we meet for lunch or dinner ever since. And we're the best of friends.
How many hours of programming do you do in a week?
22 minimum live.
That's almost
I do 2 hours on First Take for ESPN every morning, 10 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern Standard Time. Then I take an hour break and I do SiriusXM Mad Dog Sports Radio every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that re-airs from 6 to 8 p.m. The re-airs comes on then. And every Wednesday night, I do my political show, which you were just on, blessing me with your presence. And I do just go straight shooter with Stephen A. The radio show is the Stephen A. Smith Show. The television show is First Take. And then the political show is Straight Shooter with Stephen A., which comes on every Wednesday night from 6 to 8 p.m. So that's a minimum of 22 hours live every week. For at least 45 weeks a year.
And just so people know, for every hour that you appear, even if you're Stephen A., it's going to take 2.5 hours of preparation. You just think, you look like you're winging it. You ain't winging shit. You got facts in front of you.
That's right.
You got stuff in front of you. There's real preparation now when people are not. So I thank you profusely, and I want to share with you my late life ambition. And if you have any ideas, I want you to get to it. Sure. I want to do 2 45-minute stand-up comedy shows. I want to charge $200. I want to give the money to Chef Jose Andreas, who I think is one of the great humanitarian people that ever lived. So if you got some ideas, and I need 45 minutes of material, if you get any ideas of shit I can do.
First of all, I would say to you, your strength is politics. stay in that lane when you're telling these jokes, tell political jokes, because it'll right. resonate, right? You know your sports a little bit too, especially you being an LSU dude. So definitely right. do that, right? But also, right. don't frown so much. You got a great smile. Smile a little bit more, and don't cuss people out, because they're paying customers that's coming to see you make them laugh. You ain't gonna make okay. them laugh if you're cussing them out. So you got to make sure. Just follow those pieces of advice, and you'll be fine. You'll be just all right, fine, James.
Stephen A's advice are going on the wall. I can't thank you enough, man. I know how busy you are, that you would take this time. And I think you've given valuable political advice. And I'm telling you what, I'm posting it. And I'm go every time I speak at a Democratic group, I'm going to say, look, we don't know what we don't know whether to wind our ass or scratch our watch. But here's a man that connects with more young people more frequently every day than anybody else. And I think we ought to listen to it. And that is a view from the bottom of my heart.
I appreciate that. I want to say this is very, very important, because I take a lot of hits and stuff like that. Listen, I'm a registered independent who basically is a centrist that leans left. The only thing I'm conservative about is the fact that, you know, I sit up there and I can't stand high taxes in New Jersey, New York, and California. They drive me nuts. But when I sit up there and I'm critical of the Democratic Party, it's not the typical Democrat I'm talking about. I'm talking about the progressive left that you have railed against on several right. occasions. And I'm going to say this. As a black man, they have ticked me off. Because this focus, for example, on woke culture and cancel culture, I thought we were forgotten about. I'm not saying policy-wise, issue-wise, that may have been the case. But what they were pitching to, I didn't think they were listening to the James Carvilles enough. I didn't think that they were listening to the typical Democrat enough. And to me, that's what bothers me. When I think about the state of the Democratic Party today, my concern isn't the Clintonites of the world and folks like that from years ago, or even Obama when he got into office in 2008. My concern is what I'm looking at now, where you folks got us focused on the wrong things, you know, identity politics and stuff like that. I'm saying that stuff, let's get back to talking about the economy. Let's get back to talking about safety in the streets. Let's get back to talking about job creation, job preservation. Let's make sure that an abundance of women ain't getting laid off or furloughed or whatever. Let's make sure that we're doing what we can to stir the cup and stir the economy. Let's speak the language of the average American citizen that's out there trying to survive and feed their family every day. Let's speak to those people as opposed to a portion of the LGBT Q plus community, or, you know, woke culture, or canceling somebody because they got a fact wrong, or they said somebody's name wrong, or some of this other nonsense that's been going on. That's the stuff that you have been preaching about. And I'm here to tell you, I'm with you when it comes to stuff like that. And I just wanted to make sure that I make that clear, because I don't think people be getting that message, no matter how many times I keep saying it.
So the origin of this came, this is like 2020. It was during the pandemic, and you had everybody, you can't touch anybody, everything, hash, Me Too and stuff. So I'm in the supermarket in Rouse's in New Orleans, and there's a black church lady, you know exactly what I'm talking about, 16 years old. And I fist bumped her, and she said, "Boy, don't fist bump me, put your goddamn arm around me and give me a hug." And right there, I said, you know what? People like human reactions.
That's right.
That lady didn't want no goddamn fist bump. She wanted to see, she went, "How you doing, ma'am? Good
to
see you."
They want relatability. They want relatability. You know, they want to know. They want to feel you. They want to reach out and touch you. You know how many, you know, a white and black and otherwise, you know how many elder folks, particularly women, come up to me and they don't ask, "Oh, you got to come give me this picture. Come here, young man. You got to give me this hug." Okay. I mean, they are ordering me around, and it's affectionate. You understand why? Because I respect my elders. What I'm going to do, say no? Of course I'm going to say yes, okay? Because that's how you treat people. And so, you know, you just look for that. And unfortunately, in today's day and age, not enough of that is mentioned. And calling it out is something that has scared people. Well, guess what? They came to the wrong place, because they don't freaking scare me. I know who I am. I know what I stand for. I know that I support my community. I know that I support an abundance of communities out there. And I'm rooting for America always, all the time. So folks, don't scare me at all. Sometimes you got to get in people's, you know what, and let them know what the hell they need to do to get stuff straight so all of us in America can live together as one and get along as best as we possibly can, as opposed to being as polarized as we are right now. I'm not scared of that challenge one bit. And you've never been either, which is why I've always had love for you, James. Even though I think you're crazy half the time.
You know what I like about you? You and I can disagree and we can have fun and we can respect each other.
Absolutely.
And hold our I cannot thank you enough. I want to thank you, secondly, for the time that you've given me. But first, I want to thank you for the political advice that you've given. And I want to disseminate this advice because I think it's very, very important that it's heard everywhere. And I think the fact that you said it are going to make people listen to more than anybody else. So for that, I want you to know I appreciate our friendship. I appreciate your time. But what I value most is your political advice, because we got to learn how to communicate with young male.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, my dear friend.
You, man. You take it easy. Talk to you soon.
Hey, James, now for the outrage of the week. You know, it's bad enough what Trump is doing to sabotage this year's midterm elections, but his henchmen really are trying to set a predicate. They're trying to redo the 2020 election now in Arizona, where the ballot box and the courts show he decisively lost to Joe Biden in Maricopa County, which honest Republicans like Rusty Bowers acknowledge. But Trump and his MAGA allies went ballistic. So back then, this is 2021, 5 years ago, the Arizona Republicans brought in an obscure conservative firm to do an audit of Maricopa County. As I said, Biden won it by 45,000. You know what this, I'll tell you, this conservative firm found? Those numbers were a little off. Actually, Biden won it by 300 more votes. Now, more than 64 months after that election, spurred by a charge from a discredited right-wing journalist, a close pal of FBI Director Kash Patel, Trump's FBI is going into Arizona again to try to examine some of those 2020 ballots. This would really be laughable. Again, 64 months after the election, if it weren't so corrupt.
I want to come back. We talked about it a little bit in... To say the least, I am not a Ken Paxton fan. But also, I have to tell you, I'm kind of pulling for him because I do believe that we would have a better chance of beating him than Cornyn, although I'm not positive. But by the way, it's a belief I have. It's probably not as strong as it was a month ago. But my justification for everything is...
Me too.
What is the one thing we can do to help the Democrats win more elections? So any primary I look at, any general election I look at, there's only one motivation I have, and that is electing as many Democrats as I possibly can. That is my core philosophy. All right, having said that, on this SAVE Act, and Trump, he goes down, of course, he makes the Republicans have their House Republicans, have their retreat at his club, so we can obviously make money off of it, but that's hardly surprising. It was also hardly surprising as Mike Johnson spoke there. No one paid attention to what he said. But Paxton, and you know, I think I have this right, and you can correct me if you're more about this, and I want to pass that hideous piece of legislation. They would have to, they couldn't lose more than three Republicans, but they'd have to have, that have to break the filibuster. And a lot of Republicans have concluded that mail-in
votes... And get seven Democrats.
And get seven Democrats. All right. But Paxton made a brilliant political maneuver. He said, look, if they pass that, I will drop out of the Senate race. Let me tell you something. Trump, that's going to... As crazy as Trump is... He don't want to be aligned. He hates John Thune. John Thune hates him. He's made it like Mike Johnson is too stupid to know what Who cares what he thinks? He's too stupid. You know what he is. Withum is not that stupid, or Korn is not that stupid. And they got outflanked. They got outflanked bad. And now Paxton has the best answer. Well, hey, if he wants me to pass the act, I'm such a good Republican, such a good Trump person, I'll get out the race. I think this is one of the most brilliant political moves I've ever seen a Republican do in my life. Maybe a Democrat, too, for that matter. Just as Paxton, I don't like you, man. I think you're a corrupt, immoral man. But goddamn, you pulled off, or you were Daniel Morgan's at cow pens. I mean, you pulled off a double envelopment here.
James, in that legislation, the SAVE Act, so-called, the misnamed SAVE Act that Trump sent to Congress, it includes a provision that would prohibit transgender illegal immigrants from playing men's sports. So, as you know, I'm a big basketball fan, and I watch all these NCAA basketball and tournaments, which have begun this week. And I keep looking to see if I can find some transgender illegal immigrant playing for Indiana or playing for North Carolina. I haven't been able to find any yet.
You know, we got to get Jal Flynn, our pal Jay Bias on the show here. We get a little closer to, we get a little deeper in the tournament. I've been reading up, trying to catch up. You know, a little bit in college basketball. Yep. You're more of a regular season fan. There's a lot of movement to Florida right now. They're kind of a hot team. I mean,
they are. They're going to be a number one seed now. They've placed. I mean, they're going to have four number one seeds, and it'll be Duke, Arizona, Michigan, and Florida. With Connecticut slipping to two.
Watch the World Baseball Classic. It's so much better than you think. And we got beat by Italy. And by the way, in a really cool thing, Aaron Nola is pitching for Italy, and he's pitching pretty well. And then the guy from Detroit,
how's he pitching for Italy?
Because he's Italian. I don't know. The rules are pretty loose.
That's great.
Okay?
All right.
Italy beat us. We got beat by goddamn Italy. I mean, it's not the idea that Americans are the only people that play baseball is ludicrous. And I think it's good for the sport that you have. We know basketball has a large international presence. All right. Football probably a little bit less so. Baseball really, and these games are goddamn good, man. I got to tell you, the quality of baseball is unbelievable. That guy Yamamoto, pitched two games in a row in the World Series. This thing is increasing in popularity. In another 5 years, it's going to get bigger and bigger, I can tell you, because it's real, real entertainment.
All right, you got me. I'm going to start watching it.
Don't get too carried away with the American team. And we got everybody good playing. All right, they're all playing. And the guy from Detroit, he said, he'd come in, he'd pitch three innings, and you understand this, but to our audience who doesn't, this is really not good for pitchers. It's March. They don't like to throw hard early. It's a lot of sacrifice. And Scooper, who along with Skaggs, the easy one of the two best pitchers, or maybe Yamamoto, clearly an elite pitcher by any stretch of the imagination. He threw three innings, and then they asked him, Were you going to come back and play more? He says, you know what? I had so much fun. I might do it again. And they risk a lot to do this. A block. A guy like that's worth $200.
Yeah, they do.
So I love that when people get enamored with the competition and want to play the sport.
Okay, I'm going to watch it. All right. And now we have one of our favorite segments, our listener questions. James, we have such smart, informed listeners. The questions are so good. The hardest part of my job every week is culling out which seven we're going to use. I'm going to say this is one that you know a lot about. Stephen of Concord, New Hampshire, and Karishma in Berlin, Germany. He notes the president of the University of Montana and former Green Beret Seth Bodner is running as an independent in Montana. What do you think are his chances, and can he clear the field of Democrats?
Good question. Okay. I think he can. B, but it's only part of the story of who this guy is. All right. You're right. He goes to West Point. He's number one in his class. He becomes a Rhodes Scholar. In Oxford, he meets his current wife, who was another Rhodes Scholar. His current wife is a fifth generation Montanan and is a pediatrician in Missoula. Now, as you know, being the son of a pediatrician, pediatricians meet a lot of people in the course of their career. Furthermore, I think...
And they're good people.
Yes, they're good people. We like pediatricians, okay? They are good people. Actually, the American Academy of Pediatrics is probably the foremost advocacy group of any of these different medical disciplines. And I'll tell you something, they're not big into... Bobby Kennedy, the pediatricians don't like you. They don't like your vaccine bullshit. I can tell you that right now. But at any rate, to continue... He's had, I don't know, 2-3 combat deployments. And I think Senator Tester was very instrumental in having him run. But the big thing is Daines, who was the incumbent, who everybody thought was going to run for re-election, standard issue, you know, right-wing Trump up, head up his ass, but it was kind of popular. He was a little stronger than the average kind of Republican. It was going to win. It was a safe district that you could imagine. Right. Then 5 minutes before the end of filing, he gets this other guy, and he drops out so this other guy can run. I'm sorry, I can't think of his name. And then a story breaks.
No, it doesn't matter, but you're absolutely right. Right.
The story breaks that he was on the board of a camp that had pedophilic experiences during his time he was exercising fiduciary duty. So they made a backdoor whorehouse deal to deny Montanans any choice in who the Republican nominee was going to be while he was negligent in protecting young people from pedophiles. I think that the independent is going to win that seat. And you know what I tell people? Angus King is a good friend of this show. We love having him on there. He's actually not a Democrat. He's an independent. But he caucuses with Democrats. I don't know much difference between having Angus King or Maggie Hassan, for that matter, or Jack Reed. What I'm saying is this is a pickup. It's just going to be a pickup. And I am very, yep, very encouraged by the news out of Montana.
Well, I think you ought to be. I do think it's important that they clear that Democratic field because they have no chance. And all they can do, if there's a couple who filed, all they can do is help elect the Republicans. And so
I agree. And I think that to the extent it's like a Democratic establishment, I think they're all going to say this is the guy to be for.
Yeah.
But could he call it? Yes.
James, Jeff in St. Pete, Florida says, do you think any Democrats will eventually be suckered into supporting Trump or at least hold off going after him for the Iran war? That train has left the station, Jeff. There were a couple in the beginning, the senator from Pennsylvania, one or two members of the House. That was three, you know, 2 weeks ago. This war is going so badly that anyone jumping on that train, I'm mixing my metaphors now, would be a kamikaze mission. So the answer is no.
Can I say a public prayer? John Fetterman, whatever you do, keep your position.
Yes.
Don't change. We don't want you. Stay right where you are. Because you've been wrong about every goddamn thing that you've ever said. And we don't want you to break your streak. And can I assure you that the fact that you think it's a good idea is not going to matter one whit to any Democrat. In fact, it's probably going to make them even more good. So don't change, dude. Don't change. Stay right. And you know what? You might get your name in the paper more. The fucking asshole.
James, you know, you're getting a lot of political questions, a lot of election questions. Indigo in Florida. And Indigo, next time, tell us where in Florida you're from, because that's Indigo. A big state. Yeah. Do you think Alex Vindman has a chance?
Yeah. Okay.
Do I think he's a good candidate to send money to?
Okay. So let's start out. First of all, Florida's not going in the right direction. The home insurance rates are just unbelievable. The climatic risks that they have in Florida, unbelievable. We have an unbelievably strong governor's candidate in David Jolly. I can't tell you how high I am on her, on him. Sorry, David. And they have real, I mean, their Republican primary for governor is like, it's literally like a shit show. And that's giving a shit show a good right. name. He is running against a person by the name of, I want you to listen to me. The name of the senator he's running against is named Senator Moody. Who in the fuck is Senator Moody? All right? Boy, this is a real titan of the United States Senate. And I know Colonel Vindman. We saw him. We had him on a show. He was out at the Bridge Conference in late January. He's a man of great dignity, a great patriotic person. He's probably like most people like that. He's got to develop a little more confidence around people, a little more skills. I think he's totally can do it. I think it's going to be a monster year. Every special election that I see in Florida is running sufficiently ahead of expected Democratic performance where I think he has a real chance. And I'm focusing, and I've said this before, my focus races for the United States Senate are South Carolina, Florida, Mississippi, and Texas. But I could expand to places like Kansas, Nebraska, some places like that. I think the agriculture stuff is just going to be hurt them so bad you can't believe it. The combination of the tariffs, the immigration file. Now Trump is saying, no, we're not deporting anybody. Oh, shit, Jesus Christ. And then the war in Iran and the high energy costs just destroys agriculture because don't just think of tractor fuel. Think of fertilizer, which is very, very based on this potash. I mean, all of that. And then think about transportation costs. It's killing agriculture. And agriculture, I think, has just been duped by Republicans. But I think a lot of farmers are starting to see the light.
That's certainly what you hear out in Iowa and other places. And no question of
John Fetterman, don't change your position.
Charlie in Louisville, Kentucky, asked me that he recalls in 1974 Republicans began to turn against Nixon after the primary season when it was clear they were going to get destroyed in the midterm. Can you envision same thing happening this summer? Oh, only to a very modest degree. A couple of things are different. Nixon was on the verge of potentially being impeached back in that summer. You had much more of a free-thinking, independent Republican Party. So I think still Republicans, there'll be a few who, after the primary seasons are over, will break with him. I don't think it's going to help him a lot right now, James, but you're not going to see as many as you should see.
You know, to my friend Louisville, which, by the way, one of my favorite cities, and one of the things I really like about Louisville, in addition to the fact that they like bourbon and they really like horse racing, which are two... I just want to share something. It's a poll I was just sent, and it showed most voters believe Trump put military action in Iran to distract from Epstein. Okay, so let's look at the poll here. It's among Democrats, it's 81%. All right, big surprise, you know that. Independents, 52. That's actually not, you know, it's okay. The key number is this. 26% of Republicans think he did it to distract from Epstein. That means you in real, real trouble. If you lose 26% of Republicans on an issue this fundamental, the future is not bright. I thought that was the most encouraging poll number I'd seen in a while. I really did. And
there's a lot. James, they follow you wherever you go because Dennis in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia, notes you were in Melbourne recently and wants to know, what did you do there? And do you have any observations about Australian politics? Is Australia a good safe haven for Americans escaping the madness of King Donald?
I did. I was there for a couple of days. I had a dinner with some members of the Victoria, which is the state there. And then I had a long lunch, both very good restaurants, with Jennifer Hewitt, who is the most influential political reporter in Melbourne. Jennifer, I know you wrote that piece. I got to try to see if I got to find it. But first of all, it was a remarkable city, very, very culturally. So you feel very much at home. I went to Mass at the cathedral. I got a nice cathedral that was adjacent to the hotel. And, you know, Australians are really nice. And I had a very positive thing happen to me. I left my prescription sleep and BP meds in the international terminal. And I was actually flying on Delta, but the Qantas people found it. And like, I saw my name on the script bottle, and they tracked me down and returned in my bag, which I'm very grateful to Australians, and I'm very grateful to Qantas Airlines. But yes, it was a really informative decision. And you go to Melbourne. I'd been to Sydney before, and it's very international. The huge Chinese presence, great park system, culture. I liked it a lot. Yeah, I mean, speak very, very, very highly of it. You had a good time.
Okay, Dennis, he may be back, I think. James Ed in Pinellas County, Florida says, new narrative. It's a billionaire class, stupid. What do you think, James?
Oh, I think that this is right on the money. It's in what people feel. It's up there. I say billionaire, power, anything you want. I think people correctly believe that the United States government, in fact, the whole society as a whole, has been rigged intentionally by really wealthy people at the expense of people who are not that wealthy. I think we are a country, unfortunately, whose existence in government is here to serve the people that already have it made and are contemptuous and disdainful of the people that are trying to make it. And I think that's a horrible place for the United States government to be.
Okay. Hey, thanks for those questions. We just love them. If we didn't get to yours this week, send it in again. We'll try to get to it next week. So thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Delete Me, and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.